Be it resolved that B.F. Robertson, W. Worshipful Master, R.N. Brackett, Senior Warden, D.B. Rosencrans, Junior Warden, B.B. Burley, Treasurer, and S. Maynard Martin, Secretary, are hereby given the authority to borrow from the Fort Hill Building and Loan Association whatever sum of money is needed to finish paying for said building, and as a security for paid sum of money borrowed, they are hereby authorized to execute a mortgage or mortgages on the lot on which said building is being constructed in favor of the said Fort Hill Building and Loan Association of Clemson College, South Carolina, and as additional security to pledge and sign to said association the stock in said association, which is to be subscribed for by this lodge. So they have now apparently at this period in time started construction on the building, are now entering into some legal agreement as to how the building is to be paid for, and where the money is coming from.
What sources of income would the Masons have to pay for all of this?
Well, basically, there are two stores downstairs on the first floor, one of which was occupied by agreement by the bank, and the other, I'm not sure who the first occupant was, but I think it was Brother Sam Evans, who had a, quote, meat market grocery store.
I think that was called the community store.
Community, that's right, the community store. And those were the first two occupants of the downstairs of what is currently called the Masonic Temple. It goes on to say in the minutes of October 13, 1928, a special communication of the Grand Lodge was called by the Most Worshipful Grand Master, and the Grand Lodge met in special communication at the Masonic Hall in Clemson and was opened in ample form with the following officers present, and it listed a number of officers, among who was W. A. Giles, G-I-L-E-S, Ben Robertson, H.R. Christenberry, and it goes on to list a number of them. And at that time, there were about 90 people present at the dedication of this lodge, and a number of lodges were represented from in and around the Clemson area, such as Pendleton, Central Westminster, Seneca, Liberty, QE, Bates Lodge in Greenville, 6 Mile, Tate Lodge in Greenville, Fairplay, Townwell, Recovery, Crescent, and Richburg Lodge. So there were a number of people present at that particular time. And then on November 1st, 1928, it indicates that this was the first stated communication in the new building. You want to stop it there a minute?
Do you have any idea who built your first building?
I can find nowhere in the records any indication of who the actual contractor was, if indeed at that particular date there were, quote, such things as contractors in and around Clemson. Suffice it to say that this building is a solid wall construction. It is not a brick veneer. Now, of course, the interior supports are predominantly wood, but the outer walls are solid brick.
We're also, just for the record, talking about a brick building being put up when there were very, very few in the downtown Clemson area. So it was.
This was probably the second or third building in the downtown Clemson area.
Certainly we know the Martin Drugstore preceded it from the previous minutes.
Right.
And let's stop for just a second and catch up with some minutes. So after the fact, you're going to be getting rental income, but how'd you get the money to begin with?
Well, on a resolution presented by Worshipful Brother S. Maynard Martin, who was secretary at that time, whereas it is desired to borrow money with which to pay for the construction of a Masonic temple on the north of L.C. Martin Drug Company, be it resolved that B.F. Robertson, Worshipful Master, R.N. Brackett, Senior Warden, and D.B. Rosencrantz, Junior Warden, B.B. Burley, Treasurer, and S. Maynard Martin, Secretary, are hereby given authority to borrow from the Fort Hill Building and Loan Association whatever sum of money is needed to finish paying for said building, and as security for said sum of money borrowed, they are hereby authorized to execute a mortgage or mortgages on the lot on which said building is being constructed in favor of the said Fort Hill Building and Loan Association of Clemson College, South Carolina, and as additional security to pledge and assign to said association the stock in said association which is to be subscribed for by the lodge. So what we did was then borrowed the money from the Fort Hill Building and Loan Association of Clemson to pay off any unpaid bills. And then it was goes on to say at a later time, and I'm looking for the And later the Worshipful Master announced that the bill, this is November 1, 1928, which was the first meeting, that the building was now complete, and he requested the building committee meet the architect and the contractors here on the afternoon of November 2 for the final acceptance of the building. So we can presume that as of November 1, 1928, the building was completed and they moved in. Now, it might be worthy of note that at this particular point in time, the only income other than dues from members, the lower floor or the first floor was apparently occupied on the one side by the community grocery. Sam Evans was the owner of that and included, among other things, a grocery meat store on the one side and the Fort Hill Bank and Trust Company Association on the other.
And you still, of course, have business enterprises in the
Yes, they have not changed too much over the years. When Fort Hill Bank and Trust Company sold out to First Commercial National of South Carolina, First Commercial National built a building across the street from the lodge hall, and they moved into that, and that store was then occupied by Dobson's Hardware, and at some later date Dobson died, and his widow remarried a Mr. Pinion, and they are now running Clemson Frame Shop there. On the other side, after Sam Evans closed down his store, it was occupied by Mrs. Goodman, who opened a women's dress shop known as Kay's there, and was there for a number of years until such time as that shop was moved out, and it is now occupied by Vision Center.
Is the lodge room ever used by other groups, or is it purely for your own use?
Basically, it's used by Clemson Lodge, number 254, by the Eastern Star, and by a group known as the Yorkrite Masons, which consists of the chapter, council, and commandery. We have tried on occasions to extend the courtesy of the use to fraternities on campus for their initiation. And things got a little bit out of hand. Now, if a brother is a member of a fraternity on campus, we will allow them to use the large hall with the proviso that that brother must be in attendance at all times. So we do let other organizations use it to that extent.
Well, certainly your success in getting the building completed in 1928 and moving into it seems to have been much smoother with things under your control than the YMCA. I've been reading back, and even after the first problems, a year later they were still debating the issues and had not moved into the Y, so that was substantially deferred. I'd like to pick up just two or three other things from the intervening decade also, if I can. There are a number of things in your minutes that reflect very much the, I guess, patriotic aspects of the organization as well. Among other things, your minutes include, written out in some detail, Woodrow Wilson's declaration of war in 1917, and then there's also a list of the 27 members of your lodge who were in service in the First World War, and then there's also a reference, I think in 1918, to a reception and party in essence being held for the soldier Masons who were stationed at Clemson College during World War I, and that was a public reception that involved a number of women being allowed to attend and some other things. Just a few incidental commercial things, another bill from J.D. Morgan for 60 cents in 1916, bills for some refreshments, including the college creamery, also in 1918, Robert Reed for janitorial service. He was connected, I believe, with the college as well, and L.C. Martin for cigars, cones, etc., so it must have been a festive occasion. And I likewise want to pick up, if we can, just a few more names from the late 19-teens with connections to the town and particularly to Calhoun. J.D. Pike, E.B. Elmore, who became worshipful master, A.P. Landers, and Frank Anderson. I think it would be helpful, if you don't mind, if we go over and look at some of your photographs of some of the worshipful masters and see who they are, and especially note both the early ones as well as some of the others from Calhoun. Okay, let's look and see who some of your early masters were. We started, I believe, with Mr. Clue.
Yes, W.W. Clue of engineering, and then A.M. Redford followed him, who is the man after whom Redfern Infirmary at the university is named. Hook was a military man on staff at the university, and he was master of this lodge.
Was he the commandant?
No, he was not the commandant. Going down, we've got Oliver Doyle and D.H. Henry, and probably one of the better known was S. Maynard Martin, who was not only past master of the lodge, but he was Grand Master of Masons of South Carolina in 1939 through 41. Benjamin F. Robertson, who is known for his red hills and cotton.
Now, is this him or is that his father?
That is his father.
In this case, yes.
He's a son, his son. Going on down, J.C. Littlejohn was registrar, I believe, and Sam Evans was treasurer of the university.
Let's go back and pick up one.
You've got
other.
A couple of World War II officers, World War I officers, H.A. Sloan and Andrew Bramlett, who served as master of the lodge.
Both local names,
yes,
as well. And
then R.N. Brackett was head of the chemistry department and dean of, I believe, the chemistry department. P.S. McCollum, who later owned L.C. Martin Drug Company, E.B. Elmore.
And that takes us through all of the masters through 1921, I believe.
Dr. All, G.H. All, was one of the past masters of the lodge, and he was in agriculture. Dr. J.H. B.B. Burley, Dr. J.H. Sams was head of the engineering department. Charlie Bennett served as master and also as district deputy grandmaster. Dr. Sheldon was, D.C. Sheldon was later head of the math department. And Dennis Crawford,
And we're up to now about what period, 1943-44.
Yes.
Here are some other local names I noticed.
Ralph Hendricks was in 1954, and Ollie Garrison, C.O. Garrison, and R.R. Crowther was manager of the bank here until his retirement.
And was he the son of the livery fellow?
He was kin to Captain Klingscale.
Who was also brother-in-law of Crowther's.
So right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. That takes us about to the mid-1950s, and we've skipped most of the names since then because they are relative newcomers, I guess, to Clemson.
Yes, I was master in 57, and I had only been here 10 years. However, when anybody asked me, where is your home, my home is in Clemson. I've been here for 40-odd years.
I haven't kept a count as we've gone through, but looking back over the names on the wall, I would guess that perhaps close to 50%, if not more, of the worshipful masters have been connected with Clemson College.
I would say the percentage is a little higher than that. I haven't checked it out, but with the exception of very few within the first period, I would say 20 or 30 years, all of them were connected with the university, except possibly Dr. McCullum. Mm-hmm. But he would certainly have to be considered part of the university because, number one, he ran the bookstore. Mm-hmm. And also, he was the loan officer for cadets. You could go down and write a check for $25, and he'd give you the money and hold the check till you could come in and pay him off and get your check back. So to say that he was not a part of the university would be incorrect. He really was part of it.
Of course, in a college town like Clemson, it's very hard not to be connected in
that's true,
with the college.
True.
You also mentioned, I think, that you've got a close position to the police station. Tell me what you just said about the first police station.
Well, if my memory serves me correct, the first real officer that they had in town was a Mr. Mixon, which consisted of himself, a telephone, and an outside bell, so that as he was making his rounds, if the telephone rang down at the police station, you could hear it all over town. Today, we have about 15 or 20 officers in the town, in the police force.
And when that bell rang, that was an indication, I guess, to everybody in town that there was trouble somewhere.
Somewhere, that somebody wanted the police.
So everybody else started paying attention,
no
doubt. I'd like to pick up on something you said pretty much at the very beginning about the charitable role of the Masons and see if you can tell me a bit more about what types of things over a period of time that the Masons have done.
Well, they try to assist any eleemosynary organization. Over the years, it's been the Red Cross, the community, the what's called the United Way now. Specifically, there is a definite assistance to widows of members. It's pretty well limited to that, or Masons who find themselves in dire straits. We have one now whom we have been supporting rather extensively, that's really not, when I say rather extensively, that is not necessarily true, but the daughter of this widow informed me that the financial assistance we give her, without it, she would really be in trouble because it pays for most of her medication, and she is apparently
on rather expensive medication. Her husband was a member of this lodge, and we make every effort to support these people after proper investigation and seeing actually what their source of income is.
I know also that some of your members have been very actively involved over a long number of years in helping to prepare Thanksgiving, Christmas, and other baskets. Is that part of the lodge activities?
Yes, it still is.
Do you have any idea how far that goes?
Well, I can go back to 1947. At the time, Charlie Bennett was secretary of the lodge, and on many occasions he would call me on Christmas Eve and say, "Mike, we've got," and we had some connections with some of the textile organizations in the locality, and they would order X number of baskets and they'd have 50 or 100 left over. And Charlie would say, we've got to find the people that need these. And Charlie took me in some places that I didn't even know existed, as close to the university and the town. And it would, one of those things that would really break your heart to go out and see the destitute situation of these people. These were not members of the lodge. These were just members of the community that we tried to support.
Well, rather much like you, in the late 1950s, I spent a Christmas Eve with Charlie Bennett, also my uncle, and rode with him with Christmas baskets and other things to places I never knew existed. And again, they were no more than half a mile away, but he must have known every obscure corner of the town and everybody who needed anything and saw that they got it. And you know, I don't think I've ever seen a happier man than he was delivering these things.
Well, there was another organization that just celebrated its 50th anniversary in Clemson. So if that be true, it was organized, I guess, in the 30s, early 30s sometime. And it was known as the Fellowship Club, and it's still in existence. At that time, so I'm told, there were only one or two organizations. I think there was the Masonic Lodge, the American Legion, and this Fellowship Club was originally organized by the Presbyterian Church. It was supposed to have been a Presbyterian men's club, as I understand it. But they didn't have quite enough members for this to move. So they extended it, and I think it included the Methodists and the Baptists and the Episcopalians and the Lutherans, and there have even been some Catholic members of it. And the purpose was purely to help people in need. Welfare. This is what I guess the word I want to use. There was no welfare in the area. And Charlie Bennett was probably the most knowledgeable man, and it was through him that most of anybody needed anything, they went to Charlie. And he knew who to touch and where to touch and how to get whatever was needed. And for years and years, he was the man that people turned to in time of need. Today, with the welfare rolls that we have, the purpose of that organization is pretty much now it's a knife and fork organization. But they still retain some philosophy in that each year in April, they honor the outstanding male and female student from Morrison, Daniel, D.W. Daniel, Junior, no, D.W. Daniel High School and R.C. Edward Junior High School at a dinner and present them with a certificate and contribute to the libraries of each of these schools X number of books, depending on how much money we got, in their name. And these are put on a little format in each book.
Let me briefly mention a few other groups. We've talked last evening by telephone that the American Legion is, of course, a separate organization from the Masons, but has a good deal of overlapping membership and some parallel charitable goals as well.
The American Legion organization in Clemson has been a very loose organization in the last few years. I think one has to realize what has happened over the intervening years. As I said, at one time all you had was the American Legion, the Fellowship Club, and the Masonic Order. And then you started getting in the Lions Club and the Rotary and the Gowanus and the JCs and the Junior Chamber, or it's JCs, the Saratoga Club, the Optimist Club, and these are organizations within the city.
Do you know when they first started?
I guess the first one that was organized here was the Lions Club, and that was about 50 years ago. No, it is 40 years ago.
So basically post-World War II.
Yes, and it wasn't until after World War II that these came in, and then you got your welfare stamps and what have you, Social Security and so forth. And this is probably, we're talking now about the town, and then now you have fraternal groups on campus, you have the Sage Club, many, many other groups that function and require faculty participation, or require somebody who is a member of the organization to participate. And this is probably the most organized community for such a small number of residents. See, the city of Clemson has only about 8,500 people, a man, woman, and child. And when you sit down and think about it, and think of the number of organizations that are involved, that spreads your activities pretty thin, particularly if you are on the official board of the Methodist Church, or a deacon in the Baptist Church, or a Presbyterian Church, or function with any church activities. You can be gone every night in the week.
And yet, by contrast, if we go back to from approximately 1900 to World War II, as you say, there were only about three organizations in town, not only for assistance to people, but basically for any type of fraternal or other activity for men.
That's correct.
There, of course, were the church groups, and there was the YMCA, but basically beyond that, obviously, the Masons were very important in the whole fabric of the town itself. And not only that, but it was one of the very first organizations of any kind. In 1895, the Fort Hill Presbyterian Church was organized. Mm-hmm. Shortly after that, Holy Trinity. And then the Masons, maybe not quite, but nearly 15 years before either the Baptist or the Methodist Church. So
yeah, Methodist didn't come in until 1911, I believe.
So about 10 years before mm-hmm. that. So, again, the Masons obviously were very important, and as we see, doing significant activities, and most of the people of consequence in town in terms of business, influence, connections with the college being closely related with the Masons as well.
Right.
Well, I thank you very much for your time this afternoon, Mr. Hubbard. This has been very helpful in reconstructing a good deal about the not only the Masons, but their relationship to the town of Calhoun.
It's been real interesting. It's been a long time since I've sat down and gone through any of the minutes to really peruse them and pull out some of the interesting aspects of what has gone on. And it shows that the group has... the Masonic group has somewhat grown along with the town, and has established a point of reference.
Of course, your minute books are primarily concerned with the business of the Masonic
That's
order,
right.
And yet, except for the college, you have, I guess, the most complete set of records of anything about what was happening in Calhoun from 1900 on for a good long time.
Right. I was just reviewing what I've got here, and somebody has borrowed my books from 1958 to 1974, and I got to run them down.
And of course, course, in addition to the minute books we've been looking at, you've got membership books which show
yes.
who all were the early residents of the town and many other valuable
there
resources.
There are some ledgers over there that show the membership, when the dues were, I think, $2 a year, and sometimes they, because somebody couldn't pay the $2, they'd remit their dues for the year to, so that they could keep them in good standing and what have you. Even at that early date, $2 was a lot of money.
A lot of people were working for 50 cents a day then.
Yes.
So. Well, it's been very kind of you to share your time and your information in your books, and I appreciate it very much, and it's a good contribution to our study of Calhoun.
Well, I certainly hope that it helps.